Good afternoon. This is session 251, Stories from the Borderlands. Our presenters this afternoon will be Jeff Burton and a response by Matt Thurston. We remind you that the session is being recorded. Please turn off your cell phones or other noise-making devices. After some short presentations, Jeff anticipates that we're going to have plenty of time to invite people to come up and share their stories. So if you do so, you'll need to speak into the microphone. Jeff Burton has a long history with Sunstone and with this issue. His book, for those who wonder, has been in circulation for many years and probably is in about the fourth publication, something like that. Jeff indicates that besides that, he's obviously written his column and articles in Sunstone and a few others in the AMCAP Journal, Exponent 2, People Magazine, and a chapter in a book on counseling. Matt Thurston is a CPA from Corona, California, regular contributor to the sunstoneblog.com and a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. And so without further ado, we'll turn the time over to Jeff Burton.
Okay, very nice to be with you guys again. We tried this session last year, and it was quite successful, except right at the end we had kind of a lull, and I thought we were going to perhaps dismiss the group, and then people came up. But I hope you'll feel free to come forward afterward and share with us a few things, and I'll talk to you a little bit about what we want. Obviously, we want to stay with good taste and not get... everything's being taped. Remember, whatever you say is going to be heard by everybody. So, we don't want to be criticizing our church leaders or complaining about some particular thing. But anyway, I'll talk to you more about that. I'm a borderlander. The idea came to me many years ago that I don't like the word fringe. And we've heard that word fringe from the pulpit. It doesn't sound quite too healthy. But those of us who, I've never had that divine witness, and I'll talk to you a little bit more about that. That's my main ticket into the borderlands. And since I was a child, I've always been a kind of a skeptical nature, very curious, always asking why and wanting to know how things work. And I don't just accept things on face value normally. And maybe that's both a blessing and a curse. But I kind of feel like I'm. Are you familiar with Fowler and his Stages of Faith? Not. I'd recommend that book. It's one of the best books out there. But I feel like I'm mostly in stage four, a curious, wondering stage, with maybe a foot in stage five and a foot back in stage three. We kind of migrate back and forth. I do, I'm fully supportive of the idea of Jesus and Christ. I'm not sure about the worldwide Savior aspect of it. He's my daily Savior, I feel like. As long as I adhere to the kind of behavior that he suggests we have, I really feel saved. I get saved from all kinds of embarrassment and problems. I'm fully supportive of the church, and I do think the church is a wonderful organization, but that it could be improved in certain areas of policy and so forth. So why do we have these sessions? Well, why do I have the Borderlands column? What is the theme that we have going on here? The idea, of course, is to try to help people who may be struggling with emotional issues or family issues or wondering whether they should stay or go, how to be open and honest with people close to you, how to be open and honest in general. Now, these are real issues that we have to deal with if we're struggling with our Mormonism. And of course, I have also a goal to make, have the idea that faith ought to be as important as knowledge when it comes to religion. That can you hear me back there okay? I hear we have a little bit of... Okay, let me see if I can... Is that on? Okay. I'll try to stand a little closer and talk a little louder. We have some competition back there. Can you hear me now better? Okay. It's kind of my feeling like if a person wants to be faithful, that they ought to be considered almost as important as somebody who has that knows the gospel is true or knows the church is true. And that's been kind of one of my goals. And yeah, making a little headway here and there. I'll read you some things. I think we have seen over the last few years a lot more discussion of faith. You know, I kind of keep track of the ensign and the talks that come out in conference, and maybe two or three times I've actually gone through there and find out how many times our general authority leaders bear their testimonies or whether they talked about faith. And it's getting down there now where faith is often more often talked about than testimony. Not that testimony isn't important, and those of you had that divine witness, I just feel blessed and feel good that you have that because the rest of us don't. I also would like to see us move more toward honesty and openness between ourselves and in the church. When I go to my high priest group leaders meeting, for example, or maybe my high priest group meeting, I don't really feel like we're being honest with each other. And I don't feel like anybody welcomes me being honest about some things. So, and I'd like to see some changes there. But one person, what can we do? But we can try to make it better for our surroundings, I guess. So what I'm suggesting is that after we get through our presentations, I'm going to share a few stories with you about what's happened in my life recently. And one story from the very beginning, which I think you'll find interesting. Then I'd like to invite you to come up and talk about experiences you've had that made your life more successful or more honest or something like that, made your life easier, and something that might help the rest of us to live our borderland life easier. Let me first talk to you about last session, I handed out a questionnaire. Maybe some of you remember it. And we asked questions like, what issues or problems made you move into the borderlands and so forth? I thought I'd share just a few of the highlights. About 75% of the people who responded said it was Joseph Smith and his history which moved them into the borderlands. And then almost two-thirds of the people said that the Book of Mormon was problematic for them. They had problems with that. And then it went down from that, authority, temple, feminist, and so forth and so on. Polygamy didn't come out too high on that one, which is surprising for right now. But what about what percentage of your issues do you share with people? 50% of the people who responded, which we had about, 100 responses or so. Let's see, how many do we have? I'm sorry, 45 respondents. 50% of those said they've shared everything with their spouse. That means 50% have not shared everything with their spouse, which is pretty surprising to me. How old were you when these issues cropped up? The majority of the people responded between the ages of 26 to 40, and then most of the rest came in from 41 to 60. Not too many before. About a fourth of the people said that it was before they were 25 years old, which is kind of interesting, too. How about being open and honest? 50% of the people who responded said they're trying to be open and honest. But that means, again, 50% of the people are not being open and honest, or they don't feel they can be for whatever reason. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. I'm just saying it's unfortunate. Our system, the society we live in doesn't allow us to feel like we can be open and honest with everybody. Why did you stay in the borderlands? Well, the vast majority for family. Then it broke down to, you know, being part of the group of the ward. Just, you know, the genetic thing. I'm a DNA Mormon kind of thing. So that was some of the highlights. I thought that was interesting. And I appreciate it. I don't have a survey form for you this time. Uh, Okay, I've got some things here. You know, I go through the conference talks, and whenever I see something that I think warrants a comment, both positive and negative, I'll write to a general authority and tell them. And most of the time, almost always, they respond back through my bishop. So I just automatically say, please respond through my bishop, and I give him his name and telephone number and address. Elder Maxwell, bless his soul, he actually wrote back to me personally and long letters, which I thought was pretty fantastic. But the rest come back through the bishop. But the bishop gives me copies of the letters. And I wrote a letter. I won't tell you who he was, but one of the 70s, I wrote a letter talking about, you know, the Doctrine and Covenants says that, you know, some are given to know and some are given to believe. You know, faith ought to be, you know, as good as having testimony if you're being faithful about it. He wrote back, it's the expectation of what you expect, but it said, he wrote to my bishop, I am aware that Brother Burton over the years has elected to renew the theme of this letter with a number of other general authorities, including Elder Maxwell and President Packer. And incidentally, President Packer and Elder Maxwell both, when I wrote the letter a couple, 3-4 years ago, they both called my bishop and told him, you tell Jeff that it's okay. Everything's, we're with him on this. But the amazing thing here is that he says, I am aware that I've got this theme. Now, how would he know unless they've distributed it throughout the general authorities? So what I'm suggesting to you is, you know, I don't know what effect it's having. I don't see any great effect. I'm sure I'm not the only one writing. They must be receiving hundreds of letters. But if you think of something that could be positive for the church, don't hesitate to pick up your pen or get on your computer and write a letter. It can't hurt anything, and all I suggest to you is don't be too critical and be positive and keep it short. You know, one page, if you write 14-page letters, you're not going to read it. But a short letter, you know, thanking him for it. A lot of times I think, thank you so much for bringing out the idea of faith is so important. And, you know, I do both. And I suggest that you think about doing that too. We have strength as numbers. I'm nothing as one, but if we do it as a group, you know, Sunstone has some influence and can have some influence. You know, the Juanita Brooks story about her dad telling her to, you know, if you can't change the herd, call to the sideline cows and see if you can turn it slightly. That's kind of where we're trying to go with this. So that's one little story that's recent. I want to tell you about the very first experience I ever had with this. I was on a mission in Japan in the 60s, and I got talking to one of the sisters there. And, you know, we're talking to her about bringing your friends to church, you know, that kind of thing. She tells me, look, I'm not really a true believer. I didn't ever have the conversion experience and all that. Wow. I mean, I hadn't heard it either, but I thought, well, that's kind of odd. How did you get converted then? Why did you join? And I asked her, you know, why did you join? She said, well, you know, I wanted to learn English. My friends were here. Christianity really appealed to me. I love it here, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So, you know, I probably shouldn't have done this, but I went to the bishop of that branch. It was in Sendai, Japan. And I said, you know, I just had this experience with such sister such and such, and I was wondering how many people are like this in our branch here. And he was gracious enough to allow me to put together a little questionnaire, something like this questionnaire we had here. And I just simply asked a few questions, but one of the questions was, did you have a conversion experience? And why did you join the church? And the Sendai branch at that time probably had 75 members active, you know, mostly young people, some families. And there was not one single reply out of that entire group that said they had had some sort of divine conversion experience. So that said to me, people are joining the church because they like the church. They like Christianity. They like what they're getting. They're staying here because they like what they're getting. And in those days, I mean, Japan was kind of a poor country still. And there was a lot to be said for Christianity. We weren't converting people to Mormonism. They didn't care whether they're going to join Mormonism or Presbyterianism. They're going to be Christian. And so that's the way I went through the rest of my mission, converting people to Christianity and the great things that they could get at the church. So that's a little story, and you can think about how that might apply in your life. Let's see, maybe one other one or two. This one right here. This is a very odd one. You know, I get all kinds of letters and emails from people, though they can't get in the Borderlands column. So I've got some of them here to share with you. And if any of you are that I read from, I'm not going to give you the name. If you're in the audience, I hope you'll forgive me for sharing this, but I won't identify who you are. But this one is a very strange twist, in that this fellow is in the Borderlands, but he's never been baptized into the church. And listen to this. One thing that I'm still having a hard time finding is help for those of us who are not yet members of the church. Most of what I can find is geared to helping people who are already legally members of the church but are fading or confused because of their doubts. I've been struggling with this for almost 20 years, and I've heard the missionary lessons. I've read a Book of Mormon, but my disbelief in the historical aspects and so forth and so on has kept me from growing closer to the church. I wish the church could more openly accept people who doubt physical things. I long to become active in the church, but in an honest way. I long to be baptized and sealed in the temple to my wife. My problem is it seems like the doors are closed to those who admit they have faith doubts. I did write my bishop with my concerns. He calls him my bishop. He asked me to send my thoughts, and I needed to disclose them to someone. He's a great man of God, but after reading your article, I think I understand why he has not responded. And I feel bad for putting him in such a tough spot. Oh, I don't know. I've waited all out and I've prayed about it. I would like to become a member of the church and be baptized and make the associated commitments and be sealed with my wife. So how does a non-believing non-member go about reaching the next level without stretching the truth or lying? So there's a very interesting borderlander, somebody who's trying to go the other direction and having difficulty because his bishop won't even respond to his letter. Now, I don't know what this whole story is. Obviously, this is just one email. But let's see. I've got a bunch of them here, but here's one you might recognize. I'll make this my last one. If we have time, I could do some more after. But this is a woman who's gone on the internet. She's found out about all the history and it's shocked her. You know, it's a shocking experience, and she says so. She's wondering what to do, and she says she's quit going to church for a couple of months. My husband is old school. The church is either true or the biggest fraud ever committed. If I don't have a testimony of Joseph Smith as a prophet in the restoration and the first vision, I have been deceived by Satan and I am lost. She's describing her husband's attitude. I'm so discouraged. I'm a lifetime member yet feel like I've been conned. How can I stay as you suggest and still listen to the Relief Society lessons on the wonderful morals of Joseph Smith, who by any time or culture had questionable standards? And so forth. I want to see my kids married in the temple. I have to have a temple recommend. How can I answer the questions? Do you believe that Joseph Smith was a prophet? And so, you know, she goes on, I am hoping you'll be able to give me the key to being able to once again join the ranks. I'm in my second month of my apostasy. So I wrote her back, standard kind of stuff. I mean, it gets kind of repetitive, those of you who read the Borderlands column, but I've just responded to her. You're experiencing the regular loss emotions. You've lost your testimony. loss of testimony or loss of expectations or loss of your sure worldview can be traumatic as any other loss. We don't want to add any more loss if possible. Loss of spouse, for example. As you know, time and loss management can reduce the stress, save frustration, heartache, save marriages, and maybe save a few souls. Since you're only several months into the experience, you should first decide that you won't make any major decisions for at least 6 months. Defer all thoughts of leaving the church, divorce, or any other major decision until a time you have emotional and intellectual strength to make the best decisions. So, anyway, you kind of know what that's all about. But those are some of the latest experiences. I hope you'll have some things to share with us about your experiences. So I'll turn the turn over to Matt now. Thanks.
Okay. Well, to start with, let me apologize that our Stories from the Borderlands session is running concurrently with the Mormon Nudists Naked and Not Ashamed session. I realize that choosing between these two sessions must have been an agonizing Sophie's Choice kind of decision. So because I feel bad that you are missing out on the Mormon Nudists, and because I've always been a firm believer that one can have his cake and eat it too, I've decided to deliver my remarks in the nude. But not only that, I've decided that you should follow my example. So, if you'll all kindly stand up, let's do this together on the count of three. No takers. Okay. So, Borderlander narratives, like Mormon testimonies delivered on Fast Sunday, usually follow a formulaic but tried-and-true outline. The Borderlander narrative is a classic three-act play. Act 1, the exposition. You recite your Mormon bona fides. You were born in the church, you were descended from pioneer stock, you were a convert, whatever. Act 2 is the conflict. You describe your descent, or your ascent, depending on your point of view, into the borderlands. The disillusion, the grief, the anger, even the fear as you watch your former worldview seemingly collapse before your eyes. Act 3, the climax and the resolution. You explain how you overcame your grief, anger, fear, how you rebuild a new, more fulfilling worldview, and how you reconcile your worldview with activity in a church that might no longer fit you like a glove. So not one to deviate from tradition, let me add my narrative to the annals of the Borderlander Bible. Act 1. I was born in the church. Through my father's line, I can trace my LDS roots back to 1832 in Kirtland, Ohio. From my mother's line, I inherited a convert tradition. I've always felt I possessed a strong independent streak, which is to say I've always questioned, always felt more comfortable standing apart or riding a little to the left or the right of the herd. I consider this attribute one of my key components of my personality. And yet, paradoxically, I also possess a follow authority or a be an example streak, a trait which may be an unavoidable inheritance for those like myself who hold the family position as the eldest child. And it's possible that this trait may have been further instilled into me by my parents, both of whom are also eldest children. So these two at odds personality traits, my independent streak and my follow authority streak, constantly wrestle with each other for supremacy, usually settling into a sometimes uncomfortable equilibrium where I find myself standing with one foot in and one foot out. This one foot in, one foot out metaphor aptly describes my relationship with the church, with my career, and with many other areas of my life. In other words, I've always felt like Borderlander described me in general, not just my relationship to the church. Act 2. Of course, you can be something like a Borderlander for years and not even know it. I served a mission to Taiwan, did my undergrad study at BYU, married in the temple, all the while feeling like the Mormon worldview didn't fit my inner convictions and my life experiences like a hand in glove. The glove felt two or three sizes too small, a little too rigid and constrictive. But I largely blamed the bad fit on myself. I was doing something wrong. And given the numerous commandments and requirements for being a good Mormon, and let's face it, given my backslider tendencies, it was easy to find blame for my doubts on this or that sin of commission or omission. So I dealt with my doubts the same way most Mormons seem to deal with doubts they can't resolve through study or prayer. I put them on the shelf in the hopes that they would resolve themselves over time. But this shelving technique only works over the long haul if you have a really strong shelf, or if you are fortunate enough by bent of personality or disposition to only have a couple of issues that actually require a shelf. By my early to mid-30s, I felt like I had spiritually flatlined. I felt like I was just going through the motions. I felt uninspired, but I was too scared to explore beyond the boundaries of the correlated Mormon tent for answers to my questions on the shelf. Everything changed in the spring of 2005 when I attended the Mormon History Association conference in Killington, Vermont. Somehow I knew intuitively going in that everything was going to change, that I was fully ready to examine all the questions that I'd been shelving for years. MHA was a watershed event for me. I bought dozens of books, voraciously scribbled notes during lectures, read deep into the night, and met tons of great people. Most exciting was the esprit de corps I felt amongst Mormons of all stripes. The openness to examining or questioning was intoxicating compared to the strict, conforming, the prophet has spoken atmosphere of the Mormonism I had known for most of my life. The defining moment of the conference came during a panel entitled The Elusive Joseph Smith, featuring panelists Mike Quinn, Dan Vogel, Roger Lanius, Grant Underwood, and Newell Bringhurst, who I see in the crowd here. I sat in the front row. My heart was beating so hard I thought it would jump out of my chest. These men had some strong opinions about Joseph Smith. Many of the opinions were not very flattering. Following various remarks, I remember thinking, are we even allowed to say that? Just the idea of questioning the prophet, even in one's own mind, let alone out loud and with such boldness, seemed so foreign, so transgressive. And yet in my heart, I knew that such questions was part of the very purpose of life. On the plane ride home from Vermont, I cracked my first issue of Sunstone, read Jeff Burton's Borderlander article, and thought, yes, that is me. I attended the Sunstone Symposium that summer, this is 4 or 5 years ago, and coincidentally met John DeLynn, some of you know of him, in the parking lot on the first morning of that conference, it being his first Sunstone as well. I only mention this because looking at John was like looking into a mirror, and it's a look I often see on others walking around the halls of Sunstone. Like me, he appeared to be wide-eyed with that strange combination of confusion and excitement. It feels like your world is turning upside down, and you vacillate between panic as sacred cows are exposed or questioned, and euphoria as new truths are discovered. It feels like you are riding a wave and are powerless to stop it. For me, riding the wave meant turning into a compulsive information junkie. I subscribed to all of the Mormon-related independent journals, continued to buy and read Mormon or faith-related books like they were crack cocaine. I commented on Mormon blogs and message boards with the zeal of a stalker. I blogged at Sunstone Blog and joined the board of directors. I downloaded and listened to podcasts with a record collector's enthusiasm. And it probably goes without saying I drove my wife crazy. Act 3. Well, the wave doesn't last forever, does it? It may feel like a tsunami when you are in the middle of it, but eventually it dies down to a ripple. It's best not to paddle against the tide, but grab on tight to your surfboard and smile wide as the water splashes your face as the wind blows through your hair. There will be calm, still waters at the end of the ride. That is where I feel I'm at right now. I feel content, peaceful even. But truth be told, I kind of miss the edge of your seat feeling of riding the wave. So what have I learned? Jeff asked me to focus on positive things. So what kind of advice do I have for my fellow borderlanders? First and foremost, I believe you have to carve out a place in the church on your own terms. Trying to be something you're not is misery. Peace can only come be achieved when you truly own yourself. And owning yourself means owning your beliefs and your values. So instead of trying to bend or pretzel yourself to fit the church, try bending the church to better align with your beliefs and values. That might mean redefining the gospel or the priesthood or the concept of a true church on your own terms. It might mean selectively participating in various church programs. So for example, maybe you decide that the temple isn't for you, but instead you fully embrace the scouting program. Second, you have to serve, really serve. Your friends, family, and fellow ward members and leaders will cut you a lot of slack for your unorthodox beliefs if you are in the trenches serving right alongside of them. But service is also subject to the imperative that you carve out a place in the church on your own terms. I've been somewhat open with my bishop on my various issues. He understands that I'm not a conventional Mormon. But I've also gone out of my way to let him know that I feel like I have a lot to give to the ward, that I want to be a contributing active member. So how have I served on my own terms? Well, though I would have no problem declining the calling if I felt I couldn't do it. I find it easier to actively lobby for callings I think I would be good at. So far, my bishop has indulged me. I teach lessons once a month in the Elders Quorum, and I also serve on the ward employment specialist. So I help people who are out of work and finding a job. And that's been really fulfilling for me. Another example, a year or two ago, I was asked to give a talk in church on a subject I didn't feel comfortable talking about. Instead of simply refusing or dwelling on my issues, I gave the second counselor 10 to 15 other subjects that I felt would be a better fit. He had no problem choosing one of those topics, and he thanked me for my honesty. Finally, I don't advocate suffering in mute silence if something is said in church that you don't agree with. But you have to be careful when, where, and how often to express doubts, concerns, or displeasure. So for me, being a California Mormon these days is difficult. Nearly every Sunday now, comments are made about protecting marriage that, in my opinion, strain credulity or violate my personal values and sense of morality. But instead of suffering in silence or popping off in Sunday school or priesthood with an ill-timed and poorly prepared comment, I scheduled an appointment with my bishop to express my concerns and give him various articles and books that I hoped would be helpful for him in dealing with our gay brothers and sisters and their family members. Our interview took place about 2 or 3 weeks ago. It lasted about an hour. I think he appreciated my gifts to him and the positive tone. He closed by saying, quote, "I always learn something new when I talk to you, so much so that I wish every bishop had a Matt Thurston in his ward." So I took that like a seal of approval. So that is how I maintain my sanity in the borderlands. And now I guess, Jeff, we're interested in hearing from them. Thank you.
Matt, you're the future of Sunstone. We appreciate it. So what we'd like to do now is invite you to come forward. Any of you would like to say anything, share a story, ask a question, ask one of us something. But we do need to have you come to the microphone, and it would be best if you would identify yourself by your name and not take too long. We have about 25 minutes left. Don't take 20 minutes of that by yourself.
Is that better?
Okay. Yeah.
I'm a letter writer, at least I used to be. I wrote a lot of letters, and it was really interesting to me to hear.
Still not on.
No,
Maybe you better come up here. Just stand close to the mic.
Okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. As I was saying, I used to be a letter writer, at least. I haven't done it lately, but I was really interested in knowing that they circulated your letter. but my experience has been that, for the most part, they did answer me with some pretty positive comments. And one time I wrote a lengthy letter to President Hinckley about women in the church. It had subheadings and laid out a lot of information. And to discourage him from sending it back to my bishop, I put a copyright notice on the bottom. Now maybe I'm regretting that, because that would have been also discouraging from circulating it. But he did write back, and he said, and it was kind of it was on a little note paper. It was typed, but it was on a note, like a stationary kind of a thing. And he said, "Dear Sister Hansen, I read with interest your 11-page copyrighted letter. And thank you for sending me your thoughts." And it was near Christmas, so he wished me a happy Christmas and all of his other best wishes and blessings and things like that. So I don't know if it ever did any good, but I do think it's worthwhile to send letters, even though they discourage you from doing it.
I just have a question for you, actually. Can everybody hear me? No?
Just get really loud.
Okay. Now, Nick, you mentioned briefly that you had written letters to, I guess, President Packard. Who was the other one?
Maxwell.
And that they had called your bishop and said that you're okay. Could you expand on that a little bit? Because that really piques my interest.
That's good. Well, I've told this story before. For those of you who heard it, I apologize, but we do have a turnover of new people every year at Sunstone. You might know when I've been here. Anyway, I had just simply written a letter about, you know, the issue of, you know, is a faithful member as acceptable as a testimony-bearing member? That's what, a full-page letter boiled down to. And I was surprised because my bishop got a call. He called me and he says, you know, I was at my office and guess, my secretary said, there's a Elder Packer on the line or something. And so he took the call and I guess President Packer told him, you can go ahead and tell Jeff Burton that, a faithful member is completely acceptable. And they probably know about the Borderlands column and all that, and they thought I'd write it in there. And sure enough, that's what happened. In terms of Elder Maxwell, he called my bishop's home, and my bishop's wife answered the phone. Elder Maxwell? So that was made their day for those two. But they also sent a letter, and I've got a copy of the letter if you want to see it, basically saying the same thing. But again, they routed it through my bishop. Nadine, if I had not put on there, respond through my bishop, maybe they would write me more often directly. But I always just put that right in there, because I want them to know what's going on, and I'll make it easier for them to respond to me that way. But I think that's the story. There's not much more to it. Is that enough, or do you have any more question about it?
Does that mean that we have just as good a shot of going to the Celestial Kingdom as a testimony-bearing member?
I think so. But it also means that the issue actually is a little bit longer story. The issue arose because, several bishops had come to my house and in order, in consecutive bishops, saying, Jeff, why don't you get active? And I told him, well, I'll get active if I can be honest when I go down there about what my situation is. The first bishop said, it doesn't take much to disrupt a ward. You probably remember that story. It was pretty shocking. But he's absolutely right. I mean, it does. But the second bishop said, and the next bishop said, let's give it a try. Then when it came time for me to, try going on this service mission, there was an issue, can you get a temple recommend back? So that's when I wrote the bishop, wrote to the President Packer. I wrote to President Hinckley, and he passed it on to those two, and they responded. And it was okay for me to get the temple recommend and to go on the mission. So that's how all that came about. Bountiful, you know how that goes. Anybody else? Come up.
I don't know if I have the guts. I've known of Sunstone symposiums since they came out in the 60s or whatever, I guess, and I haven't come because it seems like it's too much walking a tightrope. I sang in the Tabernacle Choir 20 years, and that was a tightrope too, because I've always been honest with my bishops about my doubts. And I wrote a letter to President Hinckley before he was the prophet, when he was the advisor of the choir, I think, and never answered me. But the question is, do you think the day will come when one can be a good Mormon and not believe literally in the golden plates? And when on my mission, I thought, I've been a doubter all my life, but bishop says, just go, and I never did. I remember missionaries laughing at investigators, saying, that guy thinks just leading a good life is the most important thing. And I just had to kind of take it, because to me that made a lot more sense also. And I attended a class today on Christianity and interfaith, and I wondered, that would be better if it was Christianity was out there, because I'm thinking that the more we could realize, if there is a God, that he's a, there's only one God, and it doesn't matter what you call him, whether it's Muslim or Mormon or Hindu. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. We have a son that's going to be a seminary teacher and just got back from a mission. We go to church, but when there's a marriage, we've had a couple of temple girls and married in the temple, and we sit out and wait for them to come out, because I'm not ashamed of my doubts, nor am I proud of them. It's just there. And I don't feel comfortable pretending to believe something that I don't.
Just one quick comment. Just the doubts by themselves would not keep you from having a temple recommend. So keep that in mind for the next daughter that gets married.
Well, can I respond to that?
Sure.
I mean, the Tabernacle Choir, you're supposed to have a temple.
It's supposed to be comparable to a temple. Tabernacle Choir is supposed to be comparable to a temple recommended. I think my bishops were all kind of generous, because I and my family would come to church most every Sunday, and we would we serve on the service activity committee or this or that. And but the thing, I guess this is true, my brother who would go to our temple, our kids' temple marriages, would say that, you know, all you have to say if they ask you, you can always say, well, I don't take this too literally, and I can survive if I don't take everything, religion as a whole, too literally. But somehow, I guess, I felt hypocritical pretending that I'm not a, I'm different, too different from the, well, I'm still waiting for that answer. Can a person be a good Mormon and not take the golden plates literally? I guess that's where I'm hung up. Maybe. Among other things.
I believe the answer is yes, and you could definitely be a good Christian and not believe it in the golden plates. And a good Christian gets you a temple recommend. Okay, thanks so much. That was excellent. I appreciate that. Those comments. So, next.
Do you remember the questions on a temple recommended interview?
Well, let's let this Robert ask first, and I'll see if I can answer that.
My name is Robert Nash. I've come to Sunstone for 21 years, and I've subscribed to Dialogue for more than 30 years. And I'm a redneck gospel doctrine teacher and have done so for many, many years. Now, with that background, I attended the last session of Why We Stay. You turned the question around to the audience and said, why don't you ask yourself, why do you stay? And simply put, I stay because I have a testimony that the doctrines and the theology is true. And then what I heard from the panel in the last one, I'm sort of hearing today, although you touched a little bit on testimony, is that I stay because it's a great social organization. It does great humanitarian things and great, I have experienced great love. There's nothing wrong with that. I understand that part. What I don't understand is theological and relating even to this gentleman's questions of why do you stay? So you only stay because it's a great social organization? What about the doctrines and the theology and truth? So that's my question.
Is that a question?
Yes.
Well, I don't believe that I mentioned anything about a social organization. I certainly didn't mean to narrow it to that. I include everything about the church in my evaluation. So you're absolutely right, and I don't think anybody wanted to give that impression at all. So, but thanks. Matt, do you want to say that?
So address the doctrines and the theology. That's what I said.
Today?
Well, it's just a statement.
Okay, yeah, for sure.
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I know a lot of people, my wife included, who could say that they, you know, they have a firm testimony, they know the church is true and all that kind of stuff, but they have no interest in the doctrine of theology. And I can't, I mean, I've read the Book of Mormon several times, I've read all the books, and I'm not sure I believe literally in any of it. but she hasn't, and yet she can say that. So the doctrine of theology, I think that's just like anything else. It's if you're attracted to that, and that works for you, and that's how you relate to God, then that's wonderful. And I understand that, and I like doctrine and theology too. But for me, it has to be metaphorical. Once you start talking literal things, my mind starts going off in a million different directions. And so, I actually find a lot in Mormon theology and doctrine that makes sense to me, and I hold on to those things. Not everything, but a lot. And those things that make sense to me are wonderful. Golden plates and so forth. I probably have some questions, but I can still relate to the Book of Mormon as a scriptural text, like I can relate to some of my favorite novels are scriptural texts. They teach me how to live. They teach me how to, be happy and things like that. So I really try to separate those two. But I can see why you have that question, because I think people that are there for the doctrine and theology, if you take that away, they're like, well, why stay? Is the social organization that great? And those that aren't interested in that, hold on to that social side, because and they need something. They need a reason to stay. And there's a lot of social benefits to being, a member of the church. So that's my answer.
Do you have a question?
I just was wondering how this gentleman could answer the temple recommended meeting. Honestly, he says he can't, and you're saying he can't. And I agree with him.
Okay, and the question was about the temple recommend questions and whether we have those. You can download those from the internet if you want to. One of my former bishops gave me a copy of them. I mean, I've been through the interview myself many times. I do believe, I'm a living example of being able to do it and do it honestly. So I think there is a way to do it. I haven't lied to my bishops at all, and I've still got the temple record.
Any other questions?
My name is Scott McDonald. I had my life a little bit changed while reading a book. Some of you maybe read it by Phil Barlow, about the King James Version of the Bible and its influence on the Book of Mormon. But at the end of it, it talks about a juxtaposition between, at the time, Bruce R. McConkie and his position, and Little Benyon. And it talked a lot about what Elder McConkie talked about was knowing the theology, knowing the facts, that's what's going to get you to heaven. You have Little Benyon, who's probably one of the top intellectuals of the church at the time, who came to the end of his life realizing it didn't have a lot to do with what you know. For example, the story of the Good Samaritan in the Bible, whether or not that happened literally or didn't happen literally becomes unimportant. Same thing with the stories of the Bible. Sometimes, to some degree, with the stories, whether or not the historicity of the Book of Mormon is accurate or not, can become somewhat irrelevant. And I think it may become irrelevant to Lowell Benyon. Because at the end of his life, what he finally determined was, it's what you do. It's not what you know. It won't be a test when we go to the other side to decide, well, did you know that? Did you really understand Isaiah or not? I know that women in my ward fret over whether or not they got Isaiah down or not. Which I found interesting with Boy K. Packer's remarks lately. Skip it, because I don't want you to really get the meat that's in the rest of the Book of Mormon. I thought that was an interesting comment. So that's only my comments. I don't think we need to really get hung up. I mean, if we study history, and I've read so many books about, for example, the creation of the Bible and how we receive the Bible. In the end, it's pretty unsatisfying. Because there's as many questions that you end up with at the end of the day as you started with. And yeah, you get a little bit more information, but it is unsatisfying. On the other hand, if we're actively involved in doing, I think that's where the satisfaction, that's where the building of the testimony comes, and the feeling of love that in essence will save us, i.e. King Benjamin. And so sometimes I think we get academic in these groups, and we get carried away a little bit with the theology part and whether or not we know this or don't know that. But at the end of the day, if we serve and we really try to have a personal ministry, and I know people who have personal ministries in their lives, who really try to serve their fellow man, at the end of the day, they're the ones that are blessed with the peace of God and the love of God.
Uh, thanks. These remarks are great. I appreciate it. And I've been thinking about the temple recommend question. In fact, I've been thinking about the temple recommend question since my daughters were born 12 years ago, and how when they are going to go to the temple to get married, which it looks like that might happen, how I would really like to go to their wedding. And so I've been pondering how I can honestly answer the questions. And I don't know. I mean, this is kind of flaky. I had one friend who said, well, just lie. Just lie, because it's not right that the church take that away from you, and they shouldn't have a policy like that where you are excluded from your kid's wedding. And I suppose that's a good argument, perhaps. I don't know. But I thought maybe deconstructing each question, and maybe by deconstructing it, coming up with ways that you personally can answer the questions. For example, I mean, if you're an atheist, you could, and they said you believe in God, you could say, well, God is good, and I believe in goodness, and therefore, yes, I do. Or, do you believe in Jesus Christ? And, well, yeah, he was a historical individual. And I think you can, you know, do you believe that President Hinckley or President Monson is a prophet of God? Well, that's his title, so yeah, I guess so. You know, and I don't know if this is a good way to do it or not, but I don't know. I'm wrestling with this myself, and I would really like to go to my daughter's weddings, and that must have been hard to sit out. And so this is something I've been pondering. I still have another 6 or hopefully 10 years at least before I have to figure out how I'm going to do it. But I hope I'm there, and hopefully I can figure this out in my mind, how to honestly answer the questions as you have said.
I've been retired now for several years, but I remember one of my colleagues at work some time back who came and talked with me a lot about religion and made a statement to me one time. It was kind of puzzling. He said, when I talk with you, you seem to be quite open with me about a lot of issues, but some of your co-religionists almost act as if I'm the enemy. And there's sort of a circle the wagons mentality. And I'd never thought about that, but I know that within our culture there is this strong desire, it seems like, that if one of our number leaves, that somehow the organization is threatened. So there is this constant desire for orthodoxy and giving the right answers on things. I've thought that maybe this circle of wagons mentality, it might just be a holdover from the pioneer times when you had to circle the wagons. I'd just like you to comment on that.
There's a sociological explanation.
Well, do we have a couple of hours? I think there are people who have that impression. It depends on the individual, I think. But there are people in our church who are quite defensive. We know that. But there are others who are not that way, too. I hope things are changing, but I don't really have anything heavy to say about that. Do you want to respond to that, or do you have a separate question?
I want to respond to what you just said.
Okay, well, come right up here.
I think I have one suggestion. I'm a sociologist, and it's a consensus-sensitive group. And in a consensus-sensitive group, the Mormon Church is a consensus-sensitive group. Okay, so anything that could destroy the consensus is considered threatening. So that's why you circle the wagon, so you don't let those things come in.
Mine was a reaction to this.
Okay,
last
go ahead.
Okay.
Well, you're a sociologist, I'm a psychologist. I think there's something pretty basic that happens when you see someone who you identify with, who seems to have the same faith that you have, has been to the same meetings you've been to, has sat in the same Sunday school class, who now says, I'm not sure that I believe this stuff. because that now tells you I could have that same doubt myself, you know, and I'm fighting against this all I can, you know, and it hurt, you know, it's tough on me to see someone who I think is so grounded say, maybe I'm not after all. And it tells me those doubts that I fought back, they could gobble me up, you know, they could get me. So I got to get the person who's telling me that this could happen to me, you know. I got to stop them there in their tracks. I've got to keep this thing from going any further.
Yeah, I think just, you know, like the bishop told me, the one that asked me about, why about getting active? And I said, well, can I be honest about my feelings? Well, it might disrupt the ward. He was pretty much talking about that, too. But, you know, we have 5 minutes left, and I want Sterling to make sure he gets a chance to. Are you going to respond to that, or is something separate?
Well, let's go Sterling and Ralph.
Yeah, let's do the three of you. Keep in mind that we want to keep on fairly on time, so a couple of minutes each.
I thought I'd just follow up from the strain about getting a temple recommend. My temple recommend has lapsed in the last year, and I'm certainly capable of deconstructing. I like that idea of, okay, well, if I were to deconstruct my answer to the first question, do you believe in God, the Eternal Father, and His Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost? I believe that's the first question. Or do you have a testimony of? I can say, sure, okay, I think there's a force of goodness out there. I believe in Jesus Christ. Whether He's the literal Son of God, I don't know. I believe in being prompted to do things that have helped me. Whether that's the Holy Ghost, as the Mormons define it, I don't know. And so, I could say, sure, I have a testimony. But I guess, as I explain my deconstructed testimony in a little more detail, I don't feel entirely genuine saying, yes, I have a testimony.
I have two problems. I have a son that has two autistic children. The bishop in his ward has refused to baptize them. One's 9.5 years old and the other is... No, he's 10.5 years old and the other is 9 years old. And I understand we've tried to go over the bishop's head and get missionaries to come in. And we understand missionaries can go over the head of the bishop and have him baptized in the church. We've put in requests for missionaries to come twice, and they've never come. And the other problem I have is my stake president recently read from the bishop's handbook that a woman can be sealed to two men in the temple. And then she makes a choice in the hereafter which one she wants. I don't know whether that's true or false. I married a widow who has a husband already married to her in the temple, and she might want me. I don't know.
I just wanted to bring up some issues or questions about threats, since there's not much time, if anyone wants to stop me and give me their ideas later, too. But I, you know, growing up in the church, I was looked at more as an example, and it was a weird transition than when I first started to sense that people saw me as a threat. Me? A threat? And, you know, I thought about it. Different congregations I've visited, there's not as much assumption of similar belief. And I think in the Mormon church, it's pretty hard to contain myself. No matter how hard I try, I can't remember what it looked like from inside the box. And so every once in a while, I'll say things that show I'm not. You know, it just seeps out, and then people treat you accordingly. And I think there's some practical reason for that. I know, being a young mother, the church, it's like, yeah, you can watch my kids. You're a church member. They don't even think twice. I call up somebody for help, come to my house. there has to be, I guess, a lot of there's a lot of assumption of similar beliefs. So it is a threat when somebody's different because there's a lot of trust within that group. And other things that I've noticed, and I'd love to hear people's views on and experience, is it seems like there's some kind of borderline activity that's less threatening than others. And I haven't really pinned down what that is, but I know, for example, in my ward, we actually changed wards. We did that thing where we went to a ward not in our boundaries because just the other ward wasn't working for us. You know, nobody's called us. Nobody's visited us. No one cares. And that's fine. But then yet there's this couple that came in who doesn't go to church at all, and everyone rallies around them. I don't get it. I'm curious about that. If you go each week, but somehow you show you're out of the box and you're ostracized if you don't go, or if you have a certain other problem, maybe you can pin those down, then you're rallied around. So I thought that was another interesting aspect about threat. I don't know if there's time, but if anyone had any comments, it would be interesting for me.
Well, what's your name?
Julie.
We are out of time, unfortunately, but those of you who've heard Julie's question, if you have any comments or want to give her some suggestions, there she is in the black, I think. But thanks so much. Thank you, all of you. Thank you, Matt. And we'll go ahead and dismiss this.